Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another Science Insider show. Today I'm at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev, which is one of the major research universities in Israel. I'm here to speak with Dr. Adi Pross, who is the research chemist here. He's also the author of a new book called What is Life? How Chemistry Becomes Biology. And in addition to answering that question that makes up the title of his book, I'm hopeful that he's going to answer some other questions that I have principally about how life got going on Earth in the first place. So welcome to Science Insider.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So before I ask you, start asking a couple of questions, can you give me just a sentence or two about your own background here at the university and the background in your research as a chemist here?
Yes, I started out as an organic chemist, but moved rather quickly into theoretical chemistry, trying to understand why chemical reactions take place, why some reactions are fast, why others are slow, general questions about chemical reactivity.
Okay, well, thank you. So I think I know what life is, but I'm not entirely sure. I think of life as something that grows and reproduces and then ultimately dies. But is that your definition of life?
Well, people have been trying to define life for quite a while now and running into lots of problems. One has to be very careful about trying to define life. People think of life more as a series of things, but actually life is a process. And I think if one wants to really define life, one has to do that in terms of the process. And if one had to say what that process is, it's the process by which simple replicating systems tend to complexify and become more complex replicating systems. Life started out with a simple replicating system, whether it was one molecule or several molecules, we don't know. And that system gradually complexified because as the system becomes more complex, it becomes more effective in making more of itself, which is what replication is, making more of itself. And therefore, because there evolution involves better replicators eliminating poorer replicators, you have this general tendency to go from simple to more complex. And life, of course, now is very complex because it's had that time to evolve, to complexify, to become more robust.
So speaking about time, if I have my own timeline straight, Big Bang about 13.8 billion years ago, Earth about 4.5 billion years old. The first life forms arose, it's believed, between 3 and 4 million years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah. The earliest life has been dated at 3.5 billion years. So the view is that something like 3.8 billion years ago, that initial process to get started on that path of complexification took place.
And so the big challenge, I guess, for scientists for many, many years is that all life is made out of inanimate objects, atoms, molecules, all of which is essentially dead, right? So that's how do you grapple with that? How does something that's dead turn into something that's alive?
Yeah, that's the wonderful question. And the answer seems to be that once you have a chemical system that makes more of itself, that is self-replicating, and there's nothing mysterious about that. One can take a replicating molecule, put it in a test tube with its building blocks, and it makes copies of itself. So replicating systems are understood. There's no mystery there. But once a system like that can come into being, just come about spontaneously for some reason or other. There was lots of things happening on that primordial Earth. Once that came about, then that system, because of the principle of evolution, which is what we see in biology anyway, that early replicator would have tend to evolve to become a better replicator because better replicators tend to displace poorer replicators.
So, and that's one of the topics or the themes of your book, which is the same idea, basic idea of Darwinian evolution that plays out in biology, plays out in chemistry. Is that correct?
Exactly. The essence of evolution operates at the chemical level, and therefore the process, the origin of life, and biological evolution aren't two separate processes. It's one process, one continuous process, and the early stage is the simple stage, and the biological stage is the more complex stage, because there's this process of continuing complexity in order for that replicating entity to become more effective and more robust.
So, so take us back. So some time back, 3 to 4 billion years ago on Earth, this Earth is a big ball of water and mostly rock, right? Something happened, and I know we don't have any fossil records or anything to tell us what happened, but what is your vision of what happened at that time to get life started?
Well, I think it was more than water and rock. There would have been lots of stuff, let's say, in that water. So the early Earth would have reflected that diversity of chemical materials, just like there's lots of chemical materials out there right now. But as I say, the essence of it was that whereas normal chemistry involves one thing turning into something else, one stuff becomes another stuff, that's what chemistry is all about. Once you had a process, once a material that could make copies of itself, that its reaction was to self-replicate. Once that happened to emerge, you start off on a totally different path to the regular chemical path, and that's the path that leads you from non-life to life.
But as a non-chemist, it's hard for me to understand how these molecules that are teeming around within this watery environment turn into something that can replicate itself. Can you explain that, how that happens?
Yeah, a replicating molecule isn't something magical. It's just they tend to be the molecules that make copies of themselves tend to be long chain-like molecules that happen to be able to attract the building blocks from which they are themselves built. And by attracting them and latching onto the replicating molecule acting as a template, then you end up with one molecule becoming two molecules, because it's attached the building blocks to itself, so that you have a dimeric product, and then the two parts of that dimeric product separate, and the one molecule has become two molecules.
So that sounds a lot like DNA. Is that what this first replicating molecule was?
Yeah. We don't know what the first one was, and it's almost certainly wasn't DNA, but it was something like DNA in the sense that it was a long chain-like molecule whose precise structure we cannot know, because it happened a long time ago and the record is gone.
And so in your book, you talk about how there are a couple of components here. There is the idea of replication, also or information transfer and metabolism, right? So how it's not enough just to be self-replicating, is it? That's not yet life.
Yeah, that's true. In order for this replicating entity to be able to make copies of itself effectively, it would need to access some energy source, because that process of making copies of itself at some point would require energy. So once you had a system whereby a simple replicating system also acquired an energy gathering capability, and it could be a very simple one, simply absorbing, let's say, solar energy, then that replicating molecule that has accessed energy would out-replicate one that couldn't do that, and therefore you have the beginnings of metabolism.
And so these self-replicating molecules would join up and ultimately form a cell? I guess that's the basic currency of life on Earth?
No, I wouldn't put it like that. I would say that self-replicating molecule builds around it a whole set of other molecules that facilitate its process of replication to make it a better replicator and one less susceptible to degradation. So the reason a cell, for example, has a membrane around it is to keep all the stuff inside. So the membrane itself is not the replicating entity, but that membrane keeps the stuff inside and makes the cell, if you like, more stable in this sense of being able to make copies of itself more effectively.
And what about the second law of thermodynamics, which in my understanding is that life tries, all things being equal, everything that exists tends to a less energetic state, right? That everything kind of goes downhill, as you put it.
Right. Well, this is, I think, the essence of the problem, that the second law of thermodynamics talks about things going downhill towards more stable, but there's another kind of stability that seems to have been overlooked, and that's the stability associated with things that are good at making more of themselves. So if something's good at making more of itself, it's going to be stable in the sense that it's persistent, not necessarily stable in an energetic sense, it's stable in a persistent sense, it's going to be around, it's going to stick around for a long time. So cyanobacteria have been around, even though they're not stable in an energetic sense, because they're alive, they've been around for 2 billion years or whatever, so they're very persistent. So there is the stability associated with self-replication, which is different to thermodynamic stability.
And so you're saying that there is that given that, it's possible for increasing complexification, I guess is the term that you use, and that explains how different forms of plant and animal life have arisen, and that how the same process that drives Darwinian evolution has driven the emergence of different forms of life initially?
Exactly. You don't have this complexification in the inanimate world, you only have it in the living world, because this other stability kind that I'm talking about, the stability associated with self-replication, is enhanced through some complexity. If you have a simple system, it's not going to be very good at making more of itself, and therefore the system tends to undergo complexification, because by doing so it becomes a better replicator, and therefore more persistent, and therefore more stable in this self-replicating sense.
So was this the way in which life arose on Earth, was that a foregone conclusion, or was it a freak accident?
That is a very difficult question, and we don't have the answer to that yet, because we're still at the early stages of playing around with these replicating systems in the lab to see how easy it is to get these sorts of systems up and running. Once we've worked on these systems for some time and we have a feeling for how easy it is to make these kinds of systems, how easily they would have come about in a spontaneous way, we then might have an indication of how easily life could emerge, not just on this planet, but on any other planet. We don't have the answer to that question yet.
Do you have a hunch?
Oh, my feeling is, given the huge number of planets that are out there, that it seems very likely that if the process was able to happen once, and it certainly happened once on this planet, then it mightn't happen on all planets, it mightn't even happen on most planets, but it's hard to believe, if you're talking about hunches, that it wouldn't have happened on at least some planets, given the huge number of planets that must be out there.
And so if life did arise on other planets, what would it be like?
Well, it's hard to answer that definitively. First of all, we can't be sure that it would be made of the same building blocks as life on Earth is made of. But the basic feeling is, since the principles of replication are associated with factors that don't entirely depend on the molecules that do the self-replicating, that actually life on other planets, if it exists, would in many respects could look very much like life on Earth. And when you think about how varied life on Earth is anyway, there's tremendous variety in life, it would be hard to imagine that another life that would come about on some other planet would necessarily look terribly different to some of the life forms that we have here.
So is there an important distinction to be made between the way in which animal life arose and plant life arose, or was it the same exact process?
Yeah, no, that's the same process. It started off with some more basic system, which then diverged into the various life forms through, basically through the process of evolution.
And if you're saying, you're talking about researchers are trying to figure out if there are ways to make these self-replicating molecules now, what does that mean for the possibility of for us to create our own life forms?
Yeah, that is an enormous challenge, and some adventurous chemists are actually trying to move in that direction. But it's not going to be easy, because the problem is that all living things are unstable in a thermodynamic sense. So it's not going to be easy to get to an advanced stage of a living form without going through all of the early processes, like step by step. So one has to think of how one can get to something complex and unstable from an energetic point of view in one go, and that is likely to be very challenging.
Well, we're not going to create an animal like a lion or a tiger or a person, but what about a bacterium?
Well, the problem is that bacterium that you think of as very simple is actually extremely complex. It's just, it's a world unto itself, just highly elaborate, huge number of processes taking place. And to fit all of that together in a way that would function properly is going to be an inordinate task. The trick will be to just get a much simpler system going that is able to make copies of itself in a persistent manner.
Is that something like a virus? I guess that's not technically alive, but could we make a virus?
Yeah, viruses can be made, but the problem is that the virus isn't inherently alive in the sense that its ability to self-replicate depends on having a host that will allow it to, well, actually does the replication for it. The virus is not alive in the sense that it's just an aggregate of a number of molecules that fool a living system into making copies of itself, as opposed to making copies of the living system, which is what it's meant to be doing.
So we're a very long way from being able to create life, in your opinion.
Well, my feeling is it's still a way off, but in science, one should never make predictions too far out. Never say never.
And what about consciousness? How does, I guess consciousness seems to be the kind of the ultimate form of life in some way. So how is it that this non-living matter that becomes alive and then evolves to some point at which consciousness appears? How do you explain that?
That's a wonderful question. Nature, the life process learns to utilize all the characteristics of matter, so that life uses hard materials when you need strength, let's say in bones. It uses soft materials when you need it, say as in cartilage. It uses liquid material when that's useful, say in blood. So matter has its characteristics, and life exploits those characteristics in order to get that living thing to function. Now, the extraordinary thing is that there is clearly a characteristic of matter when put together in the right way, that has consciousness, that has this characteristic of consciousness. And nature, just as it's discovered the hardness of bones and the softness of cartilage, etc., has discovered this characteristic of consciousness. And because consciousness facilitates living things and makes them more effective in self-replicating, consciousness has appeared, at least in some living forms.
But you said the living forms had discovered consciousness. I don't quite understand what you mean by that.
Well, what I'm saying is the first bacterial cell doesn't have anything hard there, anything soft there. It's just a small chemical system. As that, even though it's very complex, as that system then became multicellular, so that the functions of cells differentiated, as we have in our body, we have liver cells, brain cells, etc., to get more, to improve function, basically. Once you have more diversity, you have improved function. then we start going down this track of different parts of the body do different things. Now, if part of the body has this characteristic of consciousness, that gives that living entity an advantage, because through consciousness we're able to make decisions and decide how we should proceed in a way that, of course, is beneficial for that living system. But it's clear that that process of consciousness came about in a slow and stepwise manner. And therefore, my view is that if we want to understand consciousness, we shouldn't be looking at brains, which are too complicated. Go simple. Try and look at how consciousness started off at the simplest level, and then to understand its essence, and then we may begin to understand what consciousness is at the more sophisticated level that we think of it as.
Well, of the animals that we're familiar with now, which of them have consciousness? Are humans unique in having consciousness?
Oh, I don't think so. I think there are many cognitive animals, I mean, the primates, but dogs, mammals generally. So clearly, consciousness is not something that's either there or not there. There's a degree of consciousness, and presumably as we go down to simpler life forms, you'll have reduced consciousness, which just shows, though, that consciousness is not something that is either there or not there, that it's a process like life itself, and therefore our handle in being able to understand consciousness is to go back and look at the simple manifestations of it, and then we may understand what consciousness is.
So, changing topics a bit, if I think about evolution in terms of, you know, organisms, and this is a new thing for me to think about evolution in terms of a chemical evolution. So when you look at the way most people think about Darwinian evolution, you must have a slightly different take on that, right? Are we evolving in a chemical as well as a biological sense?
The two processes are really just continuous in the sense that you have replicating systems and which create populations, and the populations evolve because there is a constant turnover. That's the essence of life, constant turnover. And the initial systems were simple, and we would probably classify them as chemical, and then they became more and more elaborate as they became more and more effective at making copies of themselves, until they became highly complex, and at some point we would call that biology. And what one can, it's very easy to see how this complexification process increased the robustness and the stability of living systems. Because if you want a replicating molecule to replicate, you need a chemist, a lab, students, fancy equipment, otherwise the molecule won't replicate. But a bacterial cell out in the backyard, in the soil, it doesn't matter whether it's raining or if it's a sunny day, it's there happily making copies of itself, because it's acquired all of that capability, complexity, in order to deal with whatever the environment dishes out to it. So that process of complexification took a simple replicating system, which is very fragile, and turned it into one, and it became one that is very good at making copies of itself.
And it only makes sense if you can really understand the incredible passage of time, the huge time span that's allowed this complexification to take place.
Absolutely. But the important thing to understand in all of this is that the real process of evolution was one of complexification, and that tends to be not emphasized sufficiently. Starting off from a simple chemical replicating system whose initial identity we don't know, which ended up being a highly complex system, which is life. And incidentally, one shouldn't think about individual life forms, because the complexity actually is manifest through the networks that these living so-called individuals are creating. So bacteria aren't individuals. They live in populations and in networks, and which interact with one another, and they coordinate their actions accordingly. Just as we, as human beings, live in a society, and we coordinate our actions in order for us to function more effectively as individuals.
And as you also point out in the book, that these networks aren't only within a single species, correct? These networks exist within across species.
That's right. It's a remarkable thought that when I'm looking at you right now, you're something like 10 to the power 13 cells, there are 10 times as many bacterial cells in your body as there are human cells. You are an ecological network in yourself. And of course, all these networks all come about through, if you like, a cooperative basis. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. So you're harboring all of these bacteria in your gut because you're giving them free room and board, but they're doing a lot for you too, helping you with your digestion and maybe even the synthesis of some materials that you, your body, your human cells cannot synthesize, certain vitamins, for example.
So what does it mean then for an organism to live by itself? Is it possible to conceive of a single human being alive? I mean, I guess on some level I understand it as if everyone else vanished and you were here and you had food and water and you could live out the rest of your lifespan. Does that make sense? Is there some kind of physical limitation on that?
Well, no, I think that would happen, but I think your future would be a pretty bleak one. And that's the point, that we're robust through being able to live in communities and networks and in this building up complexity process. So an individual entity might be able to live for a while, but if it isn't able to create a network very quickly, then it will die. It won't be able to survive.
So what then are the big the research questions that you're waiting to find answers for right now?
Well, I guess to understand better, and this is work that is currently being done in labs around the world, trying to create these simple replicating networks in order to better understand their characteristics, to understand the evolutionary process whereby a simple replicating network might become a more complex one, because that would be mimicking, in a sense, the evolutionary process in the very earliest days of the emergence of life on Earth.
So one last question. We're about out of time, but given your specially privileged point of view on this whole process as a research chemist who's thought a lot about this, do you have a particular take on where life on Earth is headed?
Well, that's already maybe a more, I don't want to say a philosophical question, but I actually worry quite a bit about the rate of change that we're living in right now, the environment we've created, one of enormous change, may not be so conducive for life, human life in particular, in the sense that living things have become extinct. Certain living species went extinct because they weren't able to adapt to changes in the environment that came about, let's say, through some meteor hitting the Earth or whatever changed came about. The paradox here is that we're changing the environment ourselves so dramatically, so quickly, that it could end up changing things at such a rate that we humans aren't able to evolve and adapt to those changes sufficiently rapidly. And in that sense, the prognosis could be quite gloomy, but let's hope that we can come up with some quick fix that will not allow that gloomy prediction to come about.
Well, at least our atoms will still be here.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I've been speaking with Dr. Adi Pross, who is a research chemist here at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev in Israel, and the author of a fascinating book called What is Life? How Chemistry Becomes Biology. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.